funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child, and RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, New Jersey's top lawmakers jump on the bandwagon to revamp the party line ballot system.
And if the legislature wants to proceed in that process, they can count on us for being good partners.
Plus, the Democratic candidates running to replace embattled U.S. Senator Bob Menendez have been sucking up all the oxygen in the race, but the race between the slate of GOP contenders is also heating up.
We are well positioned as the front runner. We're the only campaign that has actually built an infrastructure to compete statewide.
Also, affordable housing overhaul. Governor Murphy signs landmark legislation developing a new system to address the affordable housing crisis.
For the next decade and the decades after, we will be ensuring that more New Jerseyans can move into, stay, and thrive in the communities that they love.
And preventing wildfires.
When people think of wildfires, particularly in the Beltway, they think of Wyoming and California. You know, New Jersey has over 1,000 wildfires, sometimes 1,500 a year.
New Jersey Forest Fire Service implements a new strategy, looking to fight fires with fire. NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Vinozzi.
Good evening and thanks for joining us this Wednesday night. I'm Brianna Vinozzi. This could spell the end for New Jersey's century-old party line. In a rare joint statement Tuesday night, leading members from both political parties of the state legislature vowed to address New Jersey's controversial ballot design, which critics say favors party bosses and the candidates they back. In the letter, Senate President Nick Scutari, Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin, Senate Minority Leader Anthony Bucco, and Assembly Minority Leader John DeMeo acknowledged they have, quote, listened to the public debate about the ballot structure and added any changes would be best handled by the legislature, which they're prepared to do. The statement comes just a day after a lengthy federal court hearing on a lawsuit brought by Congressman Andy Kim to abolish the line, as he runs in a heated U.S. Senate primary against First Lady Tammy Murphy. Kim claims the line gives Murphy an unfair advantage. All four lawmakers declined our request for an interview on the specifics of their plan, but Governor Murphy today staunchly backed using the county line on ballots, but also said he's open to the legislature taking a stab at it.
I get why it's come into place and I get the value associated with it. But have I been open-minded from the get-go to tweaks that can make this system even better than it is? Absolutely. And if the legislature wants to proceed in that process, they can count on us for being good partners.
Political analysts say a change to the party line on the ballot could have a significant impact on the U.S. Senate primary. Senator Bob Menendez is staring down a Monday deadline to file for re-election and told NJ Spotlight News in a brief interview last night he'll make an announcement on his plans this week. A majority of Senate Democrats have urged him to resign. So have Republicans, including the GOP contenders in New Jersey's primary, who may see an opening amid all of the dysfunction on the Democratic side. Senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan has an update on the GOP race.
We are well positioned as the front runner. We're the only campaign that has actually built an infrastructure to compete statewide.
Republican Curtis Bashaw's confidence is high as he campaigns for the U.S. Senate seat now held by indicted Senator Bob Menendez. The Cape May developers wooed GOP county committees seeking the coveted county line on Jersey's June 4th primary ballot, even as Democrats battle in court over whether that system unfairly favors candidates picked by political bosses.
Well, I've been doing the county lines while this thing has happened, so it's a huge irony.
Indeed, Bashaw's got no qualms playing by those rules. He calls the county convention process a participation in democracy.
Different counties have different bylaws with their Republican or Democratic organizations. I felt it was very democratic. These committee people are elected to their job, to help the Republican Party vet their competitors. So I found it invigorating, exhausting, challenging, very exciting process. And what happens now remains to be seen.
The Republican contest pits Bashaw, a self-described moderate, against two main opponents, Mendham Mayor Christine Serrano-Glassner, who won the line in Bergen County last night, and former News 12 reporter Alex Zidane. As it stands, 12 GOP county committees have endorsed Bashaw, 5 picked Serrano-Glassner, and 2 chose Zidane. The rest didn't endorse, although Hudson's GOP county chair says he's behind Serrano-Glassner. Analyst Chris Russell sets it up.
I think with a solid South Jersey and big fish like Ocean County and some other places, I think, you know, Bashaw is your leader in the clubhouse, shall they say. But I think Glassner is still able to be competitive, but she's going to have to raise money. And I think Alex Zidane, you know, can be a spoiler potentially in this race. I don't know who he would spoil it for.
Meanwhile, Jersey legislative leaders, including Republicans, have signaled they intend to control ballot reform efforts. But if the court strikes down the county line, candidates will have to compete for name recognition. That's expensive and time-consuming, says writer's Mike Rasmussen.
And so it does become a completely different race overnight. It throws it into the same kind of turmoil and chaos. But on the Democratic side, at least, Andy Kim and Tammy Murphy both have the kind of money to be able to compete statewide. I think on the Republican side, they're going to be scrambling.
Bashaw says he could self-finance, while some hard right critics call him a de facto Democrat who didn't vote for Donald Trump. He now supports Trump at the top of the ticket. Why?
I believe President Trump has been vindicated on many, many issues. And I think the mudslinging in our little primary of people trying to make a label out of something that's simply not true or exaggerated is a distraction from the fact that they don't have the infrastructure to run a statewide campaign.
Zidane didn't respond to requests for an interview, and Serrano-Glassner, a staunch Trump supporter who's also backed by the conservative Moms for America lobby, wasn't available. Russell says a Trump endorsement could be a game changer in this primary race. I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
In what's considered a milestone for New Jersey's affordable housing problem, Governor Murphy today signed a bill overhauling how towns up and down the state will determine the number of affordable units they need to fulfill a constitutional obligation. The framework is considered one of the strongest in the country and sets up a formula to help municipalities figure out their share of homes for low and moderate income families in the state. But a senior political correspondent, David Cruz, reports even those on board with the legislation say it's not a cure-all.
Joe Biden, when he was vice president, said something. This is a big, and today is a big landmark. You could fill in the blank. This is a landmark day by any measure.
Governor Phil Murphy reached back to Joe Biden's exuberance about Obamacare some years ago to fully express his exuberance at today's bill signing. For a problem that has plagued New Jersey for a generation now, the legislative fix came with lightning quickness for a bill in Trenton. But Assembly sponsor Ivan Lopez has been working on one version or another of this bill since she got into the Assembly in 2018.
Thank you, everyone, for being here today. I really appreciate all your support. I'm just very emotional right now. So thank you, everyone. Thank you so much.
Lopez fought back some tears, especially being in her hometown of Perth Amboy today, where she said bringing stability to the community depends on maintaining its economic diversity.
Say signing has been a long journey for everyone involved. However, for the next decade and the decades after, we will be ensuring that more New Jerseyans can move into, stay, and thrive in the communities that they love.
Today, in signing this bill, New Jersey makes a choice to embrace our diversity, our dynamism, and yes, the dignity of families like the people who live and work in the city of Perth Amboy. And we choose those values as more important than the walls that divide us.
The bills abolished the Council on Affordable Housing, which drew some applause here today. It also more directly involves the Department of Community Affairs in the process and makes the courts an arbiter of last resort, which they hope cuts down on lawsuits. With estimates that New Jersey needs to build more than 200,000 units of affordable housing to meet the growing need, Speaker Craig Coughlin says the new set of bills will have a profound impact on that number, although he couldn't quite quantify it.
You have to put this in context. I mean, literally decades of litigation, fighting, you know, people trying to avoid providing housing for people. All of that stuff has, we really hope that this has now brought everybody together.
But even some Democrats have had a bone to pick with the bills. Jersey City Mayor Steve Phillips says big cities like his should not be exempt under so-called urban aid exemptions.
Urban aid exemptions is built on an outdated assumption that New Jersey cities have enough affordable housing and that we're incapable of producing more. It's wrong, and the fact is we are thriving and we should lift as we climb.
But beyond the affordable housing crisis, cities like Jersey City, Newark, and Paterson and others face the often forgotten crisis of low-income and subsidized housing, housing for the most challenged, the poorest, and the unhoused.
I think that something like homelessness is a scourge on the state of New Jersey. It's something we have an obligation. We are our brothers and sisters keepers. And we have an obligation to make sure they do. And the town, as I said, you know, as I said at the end, we are all better when everybody is in a good place, right? When they're well-fed, when they have a place to live, when they have opportunity, they have health care, all of those things. And so this isn't the end.
True, but a bill as monumental as this one only serves to show how far the state still needs to go to make sure that everyone has a place to call home. I'm David Cruz, NJ Spotlight News.
The pandemic put into sharp focus how deep health disparities run in the state. Low-income Black and brown residents experienced some of the worst health outcomes. A recent review of the state's response to the COVID crisis highlighted just how critical it is for public leaders to address that. At a Rutgers Health Symposium today, experts in research, public policy, and community health came together to identify existing problems and work to solve them. Melissa Rose Cooper reports.
You know, like CDC grants, there were a couple of very large grants that we were going to apply with you all too, but we couldn't because the STD clinics are subrecipients.
A day of conversation and exchange of ideas as members of the medical community attended this health anniversary symposium at Rutgers, New Brunswick.
Today we gather not only to commemorate a decade of growth and progress at Rutgers Health, but also to reflect on the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead as we address the critical issue of health equity in our communities.
Major disparities, health advocates say, have existed for quite some time, but were highlighted even more during the pandemic.
I think we continue to see challenges with health inequities in the state of New Jersey, which is a phenomenon not just of our state, but as our country and our world. But what I think we tend to see is we do make progress and improving health for people in different populations, but the gap between different subsets of our populations persist.
Statistics like Black people living in the United States are, their life expectancy is 4 times lower than that of white United States residents. That people of color in our state, in New Jersey, were 2 to 3 times more likely to die or be hospitalized during the pandemic than white New Jersey residents. That, like many people talk about today, pregnancy mortality is 3 times higher for Black and brown women than for white women.
New Jersey Department of Health Commissioner Caitlin Bastin saying her decision to enter a career in medicine has always been driven by the need for equity, having been raised in rural America.
And growing up in Southeast Ohio, I witnessed inequities and really had trouble stomaching the inequities I saw around me. And that ranged from just poverty to seeing a kid when I was young get on the school bus with me without shoes on one day, to hearing, you know, racist statements or racial slurs when I'm walking through the town. And all of those from a very young age just sat uncomfortably with me. And I decided from being imprinted in that young age, I knew that where people ended up had so much more to do with where they started and what we throw at them in the world than anything else.
Health advocates believe instead of just documenting disparities, Tackling the root of the problem means tailoring solutions to meet specific communities, since a one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work.
Some of the researchers here at Rutgers University are learning about how different communities use technology differently, either in culture groups or through different languages. And so we have to think about how do we use those tools to then meet the needs of that population and understand how they're using those tools differently. So I think that's a great example of how both understanding through research is really important to then executing public health initiatives in a diversity of different ways.
And staff at Rutgers are hoping this symposium will lead to significant change so all residents can have access to the high quality care they deserve. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
In our Spotlight on Business report tonight, President Biden makes his biggest move yet on the climate. The White House today set the nation's strictest rules yet on vehicle emissions, requiring gasoline-powered models to slash pollutants and carbon dioxide contributing to the planet's warming. It'll also push the auto industry to accelerate the transition to electric vehicles. But unlike last year's proposal, that won't need to happen until after 2030. The new Environmental Protection Agency rule comes after a year of intense lobbying between the Biden administration and labor unions, and it'll likely face legal challenges. For more details, I'm joined by Doug O'Malley. He's the president of Charge EVC, an electric vehicle coalition. Doug O'Malley, good to have you on the show. So correct me if I'm wrong, this is a less aggressive plan than the president had originally put out, but does it still achieve the same goals when it comes to cutting emissions?
Yeah, so this plan that President Biden and his administration announced today in Washington will be the single most significant regulation in history to reduce climate pollutants. It will take a little longer to ramp up, but it's going to get to the right place at the end of the day. And that's really critical, because we're at a moment right now of an inflection point where across the country, we need to be getting more drivers behind the wheels of electric vehicles.
What does it apply to, though? Because there are some stipulations around not just all electric vehicles, but also some carve-outs for hybrid and plug-ins. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's important to kind of know that the transition to electric vehicles is going to be multifaceted. So obviously, your pure battery electric vehicle, those are the ones that have the best bang for the buck for consumers to save the most amount of money and get just the pure driving experience of an electric vehicle. That being said, you know, some people are going to prefer the plug-in hybrid. Those plug-in hybrids will be part of this regulation. They're a part of New Jersey's clean car standards. And for those drivers that are really worried about range anxiety, that's a good middle ground. So, you know, this regulation that EPA is moving forward on is doing the right thing for the climate, is doing the right thing for air pollution, and is providing the path forward to accelerate electric vehicles all across the country, not just in New Jersey.
But it's not, as some states are doing, including what New Jersey is looking at, mandating that auto manufacturers stop the production of gas-powered vehicles. Yes, it is working around that a bit more?
That's right. And so this is important to know that New Jersey for two decades has been stronger than what the federal government has required. And 40% of the auto market is now in states just like New Jersey that have strong clean car standards. But we need to make sure that we're raising the floor. And if you're in Texas or Pennsylvania or Alabama, you too should have the option to have an electric vehicle. And this regulation as it stands will actually save drivers $6,000 a year with decreased maintenance costs. So this is a reminder that electric vehicles aren't for the future anymore, they're here. But we want to make sure that they are more accessible and available for more consumers across the country.
How many more electric vehicles do we expect to have on the road by 2030 because of this rule? And how much emissions do we expect to be cut?
Yeah, so this is why this rule is so significant. And the rule does ramp up a little more slowly this decade and has a steep ramp up after 2030. But by 2032, more than half the new cars sold in the United States would most likely be zero emissions vehicles in order to meet these standards. And that has a huge climate benefit. That would save more than 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide over the next 30 years. That's the equivalent of removing a year of greenhouse gases in this country. So when we talk about the climate crisis being real, these are the kind of actions that we need to take.
Doug O'Malley is the director of Environment New Jersey and the president of Charge EVC in New Jersey. Doug, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Brianna.
On Wall Street, stocks popped today after the Federal Reserve held interest rates steady and stuck to its projection of 3 rate cuts this year. Here's how the markets closed.
Support for the Business Report provided by the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce, announcing its Renew Jersey Business Summit and Expo, March 26th and 27th at Harrah's in Atlantic City. Event details online at njchamber.com.
Spring is officially here, and that puts us at the peak of New Jersey's wildfire season. New Jersey Forest Fire Service today began controlled burns throughout the state. It's all part of a strategy to prevent wildfires by eliminating their sources of fuel. That's especially critical for the communities in and around Joint Base McGuire-Dix Lakehurst, which are at higher risk because of the combustible landscape. To reduce the threat, the Department of Defense is working with the state to build and maintain what they call fuel breaks. Raven Santana has the story.
When people think of wildfires, particularly in the Beltway, they think of Wyoming and California and Colorado, Texas. Well, you know, New Jersey has over 1,000 wildfires, sometimes 1,500 a year.
Wildfire season in New Jersey has historically been from mid-March through mid-May, but it has gotten longer during the past decade, with major wildfires occurring in February and extending into the summer, which is why the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection Forest Fire Services is partnering with the Department of Defense to conduct more prescribed burns like this. It's all in an effort to reduce wildfires that made 2023 the busiest fire season in more than a decade.
The last significant wildfire to directly impact the Roosevelt City community occurred in May of 2020 and affected 99 acres of forest not far from where we stand today.
This demonstration that took place in Roosevelt City in Manchester Township is just one of 3 wildfire resiliency projects in the Pinelands funded through the U.S. Department of Defense's Readiness and Environmental Protection Integration Challenge Program, also known as REPI. These projects have created or maintained more than 30 miles of fuel breaks in the vicinity of 2 military bases, including Joint Base McGuire-Dix Lakehurst. Fuel breaks are strips of land where the vegetation is reduced or modified to prevent fires from spreading.
Our work with the local, county, state, and federal partners is essential to ensuring the success of projects like this that afford the protection to the local communities, to the people that live and work here. Thanks to the fuel break, prescribed burning can now be conducted safely around the Roosevelt City communities.
New Jersey Environmental Protection Commissioner Sean LaTourette says fuel breaks are the key to ensuring the safety of life and property.
What we've seen, because of these periods of more dry conditions interspersed by, you know, pretty fierce and intense rainfall, that our burn season gets a bit interrupted, right? So we try to get started a little earlier, keep it going for as long as we can. But in the last few years, we haven't been able to reach our tens of thousands of acres of treatment area, in part because of these really rapidly changing conditions.
Prescribed burning is also used as a way to maintain the effectiveness of fuel breaks, which LaTourette says is now critical, as he's concerned this wildfire season could turn into a wildfire year.
Because the reality is that New Jersey is ground zero for some of the worst impacts of climate change. Those impacts include a lengthening wildfire season. Sometimes I think we should start thinking of it as wildfire year. We had nearly 1,200 wildfires last year. As you heard me before, 14 of them major, burning 18,000 acres, right? That is considerable risk to people, to property, to public health and safety, and to the environment that we share.
Officials say projects like this are just one part of preparation. It's also important for property owners to reduce fire threats around their homes.
Our biggest message to people, you know, in New Jersey and nationwide, is that defensible space is the key to success. It's the key to saving your home, to be prepared, and to take advantage of all of the resources that are offered out there to keep your home and your property safe from wildfire. Because the time to plan for it is not when you see the smoke.
For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Raven Santana.
And that's going to do it for us tonight. But make sure to tune into Chatbox with David Cruz tomorrow night. David continues the conversation over the controversial party line ballot system with Democratic Party Chair Leroy Jones. That's Thursday at 6 p.m. on our NJ Spotlight News YouTube channel. I'm Brianna Venosi for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. And by the PSCG Foundation.
Have some water.
Look at these kids.
How are you?
What do you see? I see myself. I became an ESL teacher to give my students what I wanted when I came to this country. The opportunity to learn, to dream, to achieve, a chance to belong and to be an American. My name is Julia Toriani Crompton, and I'm proud to be an NJEA member.
Our future relies on more than clean energy. Our future relies on empowered communities, the health and safety of our families and neighbors, of our schools and streets. The PSEG Foundation is committed to sustainability, equity, and economic empowerment. Investing in parks, helping towns go green, supporting civic centers, scholarships, and workforce development that strengthen our community.